Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the Great Game and whether Tsarist Russia's expansion through Central Asia posed a challenge to India that British soldiers and diplomats feared.
Last time we discussed the Great Game and its origins in what could be called, from the European perspective, the Eastern Question, and we took that into the early 19th century. And today I want, as a sequel, and it's advantageous to listen to the earlier one, though you don't have to take the Great Game, the competition between Britain and Russia in the 19th century, focused on Central Asia, and more particularly with names resonant today, such as Afghanistan. And I want to take that through the 19th century and into the 20th century. And one of the things I'm trying to bring out is long-term themes. I don't want to get drawn into the minutiae of why there were British troops advancing on Kabul at particular moments, why there were three Anglo-Afghan wars, because those are relatively well covered in the literature. What I think is less well covered is the historiographical dimension. And there is also the problem that the Great Game, so-called, is treated as a 19th century phenomenon. There was discussion when the Afghanistan question revived for America and Britain. It had always been there for the Afghans. In the early 21st century, there was a discussion of the Great Game's resonances. But what I want to do is actually say there's a continuity. And in terms of the continuity, I want to bring out not just the role of the two classic, as it were, players, though do remember at every stage, real people were involved, real people risked their lives, real people lost their lives. So I want to bring out not just the conventional two players, but also to emphasize that there were more than two, and that that actually looks towards the present day. So let me start off by talking about some of the other players. Number one, in the case of Britain, actually, you could argue that there were two players. And indeed, this thesis, in a way, underlay the work of, for example, Edward Ingram on geopolitics in the 1790s, 1800s. It underwrited also the work of John Brobst, a rather good American scholar who's written on Karu and British Indian policy, geopolitical policy in the 1940s. And what I would say is this, that British policy could be understood both as policy emanating from London and also as policy emanating from the British authorities in India. Now, there were both civil and military authorities. They were not necessarily of one mind, each of them, let alone together. But they often acted as a, in a sense, autonomous, sometimes independent, sometimes interacting source of policy and initiatives compared to the ministers in London, and in some respects, a much more important proactive force in terms of expansion, for example, into Afghanistan's Sindh and the Punjab in the 1830s and 40s, and indeed in many cases taking what one might call a forward policy, a policy of protecting India, British India, by seeing its defences and its buffer zones as further and further forward. Now, the point about that is that that looks to the present day, because you could argue that alongside the narrative of Indian nationalism, which endlessly beats up against how awful the British were, I was reading yet another rather facile book on that theme today, there is the degree of continuity between British policy and Indian policy and geopolitics in terms, for example, of attempting to dominate Himalayan neighbours such as Nepal, in terms of trying to dominate Sri Lanka, in terms of competition with China, and in particularly in terms, if you were thinking of this in terms of both India and Pakistan and their rivalry, in terms of the attempt to dominate Afghanistan. So for Pakistani strategists over the last 20 years. And one of the reasons why they were had links with the Taliban was their view that Afghanistan was a kind of Indian ally against Pakistan, and that needed in turn, that alliance needed in turn to be overthrown. Now, we can discuss or debate the merits of that. That's not my point. My point is that this looks back to a long continuity in which there is Britain and then India or British India as a player. Number two, a player that tends to be neglected is China. And that's important because we can now see China as playing a significant role, an ambitious role in Central Asia, an ambitious role in trying to develop communications and economic links in Pakistan, an ambitious role in taking oil from Iran and Iraq, an ambitious role in competing with India in the Indian Ocean and in its littoral. Now, this may appear to be just some sort of recent occurrence. But in fact, it looks back again to themes of Chinese geopolitics. And we don't have to go right back to, say, the Tang Dynasty. One can actually look at that in 18th and 19th century terms, the expansionism of the Qing or the Manchu, if you like, in the 18th century into Tibet, into Sinkiang, into Kashgar, Chinese Turkestan and beyond, influence in Kazakhstan. And there is an element to which today there is resonance. In the 19th century, as you may be aware, late 19th century in particular, China had faced a sense of decline and a reality of problems. There were insurrections, not least in the Islamic Northwest, the area of Sinkiang. There were insurrections in the southwest. There's a sense of competition with Britain in the Himalayas and Tibet. There is a real competition as well with Russia in the Amur Valley and what becomes the Russian Far East. The point of this is that all of them link directly to the present day. And rather than thinking about the modern day China question as, in a sense, one about the recovery of China economically in the last few decades, its growing competition with America, one can actually say, yes, those elements all exist, but they look back to the 19th century, and so does China as a Central Asian player, a, as it were, second-rank state in the 19th century in competitive terms compared to Russia and Britain, but now a first-rate state. Then there were also, in the 19th century, what one might term the regional players, states that were concerned to, as it were, subjugate areas that over which it had, they had sovereign rule, but areas which were autonomous. So you can see that, for example, in Persia, or what we would now call Iran. You can see that, for example, in the Turkish Empire. And the point about that, and you can indeed see that in those territories in Central Asia that were overcome by Russian expansion, and the big territory that was not overcome by Russian expansion, which was Afghanistan. Now, the point about that is to bring out the extent to which there were these, if you like, second or third order players, that they had the capacity for independent initiative, that their moves often pressed on other powers, so Persian sieges of, or expansionism, but actually in one case a major siege of Herat in western Afghanistan leads Britain to try and beat up on the Persians. Persian expansionism into Baluchistan subsequently leads to British expansionism in southern what is now Pakistan, and so on and so forth. So there is a multiple series of players, and to treat it as is generally treated, as simply an Anglo-Russian rivalry, is foolish and feckless. The last point before we move on to, as it were, a more formal discussion with Graham, is I want to look briefly, and I'm going to cite one or two documents here. I want to look briefly at the move into the into the 20th century. And I want in particular to look at the origins of geopolitical theory, British geopolitical theory, in the case of Sir Halford Mackinder and his famous 1904 discussion of the extent to which there was an Asian heartland and geopolitical competition was a matter of the rivalry for this heartland. And for the British, as he saw it, the British were the peripheral power, they were resisting Russia, and their peripheral bases were Britain, India, as British India, and the alliance with Japan. And we're coming here, I'm citing from Halford's paper, The Geographical Pivot of History, published in 1904. And Halford in it uses the term the pivot, and the term the heartland. And he argued, quote, the heartland of Eurasia constituted, quote, the pivot region of the world's politics. Mackinder himself saw Europe in European history subordinate to Asia and Asiatic history. The European civilization is the outcome of the secular struggle against Asiatic invasions. For 1,000 years, a series of horse-riding peoples emerged from Asia. He then argued, Russia replaces the Mongol Empire. Her pressure on Finland, on Scandinavia, on Poland, on Turkey, on Persia, on India, and on China replaces the centrifugal raids of the steppe man. The camel men and the horsemen are gone. No, are going, sorry. Railways will take their place, and then you will be able to fling power from side to side of this area. So for Mackinder, and Mackinder is not just some academic, he is a key player at the London School of Economics. He becomes a Liberal Unionist Member of Parliament. He's very influential in parliamentary circles. He moves on to be British High Commissioner in South Russia after World War I, at the time of British intervention in Russia in the Russian Civil War, and he is a key player. Now, we can go on, and I can quote from Mackinder. I don't want to do that, but what I want to do, because you know, you can read the paper, it's easily available, and you can actually get it online these days. But what I want to do is to say that Mackinder's sense of continuity, his sense that, if you like, I mean, we're using the term the great game, but he's arguing that it's much more broad-ranging than who conquers Afghanistan. It's as equally a matter of who presses on Poland, who presses on Manchuria, whether the central pivotal power can be replaced, restrained. And he actually says, and he's very strong on this in 1919, as is the British General Staff, and I quote a General Staff report in my book on interwar conflict, in which the General Staff says the most planning document of 1919, the most dangerous configuration for Britain would be an alliance between Russia and Germany. Now, Mackinder himself had argued the same thing, either Germany taking over Russia, Russia taking over Germany, or cooperation between the two. And we, of course, are to see this in 1939, 1941. And you could argue that anxiety about it is what helps to drive the forward deployment of NATO, the creation of NATO, and the forward deployment of British and American forces in NATO into West Germany, this very concern. So, what we are arguing here is that the great game, whilst it is fascinating to talk about redcoats moving through the Khyber Pass, and indeed I have been to the Khyber Pass and it is very interesting, and I've been to Kabul and they are very interesting, whilst it's interesting to see that kind of resonance, actually that is, as it were, to underrate the significance of Eurasian geopolitics, the dynamics affecting it, and the sense of continuity within it. Over to you, Graham.
Well, Professor Black, thank you very much for painting the geopolitical framework and also setting out some of the primary and secondary powers involved. I want to start by asking a question about one of the primary powers, and that is the British, and whether you see a difference coming from 1857, by which I mean the period before that, the British presence is primarily through the East India Company, after 1857, following the Indian Mutiny, the British Crown replaces East India Company presence. Does that, in a geopolitical sense, change anything?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I would say that you've got several different models to look at. If one model is the action-reaction model, a lot of it is responding to a sense of Russian expansion. For the British state itself, there are a range of geopolitical commitments, there are a range of territorial areas of interest, and there is the pressing burden of domestic finance and the desire to contain that. There is the fact that Britain is the foremost naval power, and activities in Afghanistan are, to put it mildly, a distraction from that. And, you know, there's the big naval expenditure on moving into the age of the ironclad and responding to Napoleon III's development of Cherbourg, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole host of other issues. So that's, I think, I'd start off with saying one. But you are absolutely right that the creation of British India as a more specific and explicit governmental unit within the British Empire, in which the state has a direct concern and in which there is a very large army, and in, one ought to add, significant generals and military patronage, whether you're talking about Napier or Wolseley or Roberts, all of those encourages concern. There is also concern about the defences of India. To us, British India was clearly safe. And obviously the overawing, the overcoming of the Indian Mutiny with, you know, let us remind modern Indian nationalists, most of the Indians that fought on the British side, as opposed to fighting against the British in that crisis. And then subsequently, there was no recurrence of the Indian Mutiny. Nevertheless, that underrated, as it were, both the sense of the friability of India's borders as a whole, particularly, I would say, not just the northwest frontier, but also, interestingly enough, Burma, but also, and the broader Indian Ocean pattern, but also there is this sense of uncertainty about Russia, Russian intentions, what they can lead to, and the extent to which the possibility of Russian encouragement would lead to an alliance against Britain of native powers outside British India. And that, in a way, is the great significance of Afghanistan. In other words, if Afghanistan is encouraged and or armed by the Russians, that is a problem for Britain, irrespective of how many actually Cossacks there might be at Peshawar. And that element, I think, has, you know, sometimes been underplayed, that when you're talking about Afghanistan, you're also talking about Russia. It's in a sense that it's rather like, although there wasn't the ideological affinity at all, not at all the ideological affinity, it's rather like geopolitical concerns about Cuba. You know, is this going to be a base for hostility? Is it going to be a base that might lead to the stirring up of an Islamic rising in what is now Pakistan, northern India? Is there a real tension here? And, you know, you see that surfacing in imaginative fiction, the idea of the British Empire being vulnerable, you know, looking towards imaginative fiction like Greenmantle. You see it looking towards German speculation at the time of World War I about being able to use international Islam as a way to overthrow the British. You see it in interwar attempts by a number of powers, principally the Soviet Union, Italy, and Germany, to see whether they can, as it were, fish in problems for the British, particularly in Persia, but also in Afghanistan. And all of that encourages this sense of British anxiety. And anxiety is often countered by a forward policy, not always countered, but is often countered by a forward policy, which then brings the commitment of needing to protect client rulers and military groupings. And you could argue that that's what's happened in Afghanistan in the last 20 years, albeit with much greater cost.
Well, I want to probe a little further on this subject of British anxiety and the nature of whether Afghanistan is potentially a launch pad for Russian penetration through into India, or is more just a destabilizing country which has to be dealt with. And I want to feed that question into also the topography and whether realistically, given the mountainous nature of a lot of Afghanistan, whether actually it was ever realistically going to be a route through which Russia, had it been so minded, could have invaded India.
Well, I think that's a very good question. In my view, no. But in my view, obviously, there was the possibility of causing problems for British interests. And that, I think, it's fair to say, is more creditable. And you've got to bear in mind, when you're talking about India, you're talking about India's frontiers being roughly where those of Pakistan are today. So that is closer to Central Asia. Obviously, the Russians move quite rapidly into Central Asia, having had relatively little success, not that that was the only thing they were doing, in deep penetration in the 18th or early 19th century. Places like Samarkand, Bukhara, Khiva, and Merv all fall. I noticed that Merv goes in 1884, and in 1885, in the Penjdar crisis, which a former PhD student of mine, Robert Johnson, who's now got a job in Oxford, a very good scholar, he wrote a thesis on this crisis. You know, the Russians advanced what we would now call the northern border of Afghanistan, and there is the possibility of war with Britain, because the uncertainty of that border at that time leads to the question of whether the Russians are actually invading Afghanistan and whether Britain is obliged to come to Afghan in support. So that's, as it were, a problem. If you're going to run Afghanistan as a buffer state, or indeed, as they try at some stages, the Ottoman Empire as a buffer state, or Persia as a buffer state, or you might say at the present moment, Estonia is a buffer state for NATO, it's a member of NATO, whatever you're going to say, if you're going to run places as a buffer state, then you do have to think about defending them. So your intention might only be to defend the frontiers of British India, but you might find that without necessarily imagining that the Russian troops are going to be in Lahore tomorrow, you are actually finding you're defending some frontier that's theoretically on the Amu Darba, you know, however you want to pronounce it, which I can tell you, you've asked about the topography. I've been there, I've seen it. It's not going to keep many people back for very long, particularly in the dry season. There is that problem. We don't have to imagine or think about the way in which we're talking about a pre-aircraft era. Obviously, it changes in the aircraft era. I mean, as you know, armies could penetrate very adverse terrain in that part of the world. Alexander the Great had marched through Afghanistan to the Indus and crossed the Indus. Or if you're going to think, 1646-7, Aurangzeb, the Mughal emperor, him as prince, crosses the Hindu Kush and marches into what is now northern Afghanistan. He finds it bloody difficult. The Uzbeks are a real nuisance to him, and he ends up going back. But there isn't this sense of a clear frontier. And again, he filled through the 18th century. Nadir Shah of Persia invades India successfully in 1739, capturing Delhi for a while. The Afghans invade from the mid-1750s onwards. on repeated occasions. So there's no necessary frontier. The topography may be difficult. That does not preclude operating.
Mm-hmm. And does mastering the topography become easier as the 19th century goes on? Are the railways from the British side, railways and better roads going into Afghanistan, which would could be turned to Russia's advantage if they invade? And similarly, given the nature of Tsarist Russia, how easy is it really for Russia to move lots of divisions across Central Asia through Afghanistan at a time when there presumably aren't railways?
I'm not suggesting that a large Russian army was going to march through Afghanistan. What I am suggesting is that the capacity of Russia to press on allies or potential allies that are seen as buffer states will trigger anxieties. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I think we've discussed the Russo-Japanese War in one of these programs. That was jolly difficult. I mean, the Russians managed it. That had an extraordinarily long communication and supply route with for a long time, the Trans-Siberian not being complete. Your actual question about railways is a good one. Railways can take you towards the battle sphere, but not really into it, but I don't think that's quite the point. I don't think there, if the British and the Russians wanted to fight each other, they could fight each other much more readily around the Dardanelles, as seemed possible in 1878. Or if you look at the war planning for the Peshmerga crisis, in fact, the crisis was going to, in theory, arise as a consequence of divisions over the North Afghan frontier. The assumption was that the fighting would be all over the place, that, there'd be fighting off Vladivostok, there'd be, the British would send an expeditionary force potentially to round Murmansk, which again had been, so in other words, you don't have to fight in the area that is the source of conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can fight there, but it doesn't have to be all the fighting there. So I think that is a point to bear in mind. But if what you're saying to me is, was there untoward anxiety? Yes. I mean, I referred last time to Lord Salisbury, a very clever man, Lord Salisbury's view that people using maps of the wrong scale were helping to make the distances seem less than they were. That is correct. And secondly, I would add, published a history of logistics, and in contradiction to the usual view that logistics get better with time because you have greater technology, I would say actually they become more vulnerable with time because you are requiring this greater technology. So I would say that a Mongol cavalry force had better logistics than a, 1960s Western army dependent on petrol supplies and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're discussing this at a time when NATO powers are trying to work out what Russia is planning on Ukraine. For the Ukraine, is it going to be an invasion? Are the Russians merely attempting to destabilize the situation to put diplomatic and strategic pressure on Ukraine and Western countries? Is it a comparable situation with what the Russians actually intended with Afghanistan and elsewhere in India? Not so much a formal invasion, but using Afghanistan and other powers in the region in order to try and have leverage over the British?
Well, that's an excellent question. Can I just start off by making a sarcastic point? You are very kind when you refer to NATO powers. I think we might maybe refer to them as NATO states. I think what Germany in particular is showing is you can be a major economic powerhouse and be a military pygmy. So
NATO members, there we are.
Yes, yes. Well, first of all, In the case of Vladimir Putin, and indeed, I think it's fair to say he's not alone in this, Ukraine holds a much closer role. I'm not saying that I'm justifying Russian policy for a second, which I do not wish to justify, but Ukraine has a much closer part in Russian emotional, cultural, geopolitical, economic, sort of ethnic concerns than Central Asia does. So for Russia, much more is at stake in the Ukraine issue than was at stake in who the hell ran Afghanistan in the 1880s. You know, so I think that is point number one. And I think that reflects the way in which, although it's true, we discussed the Russo-Japanese War, Russian policymaking has primarily been set by the concerns, strategic concerns of European Russia. There have been debates, long old-standing cultural debates, obviously, between Slavophiles and Westernizers. There have been debates upon people as to how far Russia should or shouldn't seek to expand, whom it should ally with, and all the rest of it. But the common characteristic was they were essentially concerned with the ambit of European Russia. In the late 19th century, in a general era of imperialism and expansionism, yes, there is more concern about expanding Russia's Asian empire, but that is secondary for most of Russian history. Now, if you're asking me about continuities between the past and today, what I would say is what we were discussing last time, the extent to which Ukraine was important in what I think we can fairly call the Eastern question. And we discussed how that developed in the 17th and 18th centuries. And, you know, we brought out how Russia annexed Crimea in 1783. We could then look forward to the program that you and I did on the Russian war with the Western alliance over Crimea in 1854-6. We can look forward, not that I'm implying that these are in any way coterminous or equivalent, we can look forward to geopolitical conflict and foreign intervention in the 19-teens, World War I and the Russian Civil War, in the 1940s, World War II. And suddenly there is a sense of continuity. And I mean, I remember going to Sevastopol and, you know, I was going as most British plonkers would, looking at Crimean War battlefields. But of course, I also was well aware, and there was masses of stuff to see, about the two sieges of Sevastopol in World War II, first the German siege and then the Soviet siege. And to modern Russians, that was more pertinent in a sense. So, and obviously there's the Ukrainian narrative as well. As I said, I'm not justifying the Russians, I'm talking about the way that there is a narrative. So in many respects, Afghanistan reflected in its historical pedigree for Britain a British approach to South Asia predicated on Britain being the great South Asian empire. Once that South Asian empire goes in the late 1940s, then Britain's presence in Afghanistan becomes totally extraneous to any understanding of British strategic interest, because the containment of the Soviet Union in the Cold War is fundamentally for the European powers through NATO and through Britain, I'd say as well, which, you know, is a major naval power, through naval commitments, that there were interest, obviously, in CETO and in CENTO, in an Asian sort of aspects of this in the 1950s and 60s, but Britain pulled, Afghanistan wasn't part of that, Britain pulled out of east of Suez, and anyway, the collapse of Iraq, of the Iraqi monarchy in 1958, really dealt a hammer blow to Britain's presence in that strategic presence there with the air bases. So I would actually say that whereas you can see a firm continuity in Soviet Russian terms, in British terms, quite frankly, there was no real historical resonance when British troops went in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And, you've got various talented journalists who've got nothing better to do, well, they've got copy to fill, suggesting that there was, but they were mistaken.
How much do historians know or think they know about the motivations of the various emirs and rulers of Afghanistan during this period? To what extent were they willingly the puppet of either Russia or the British, or were they trying to play a game, trying to play one off against the other, and sometimes it backfired? What do we really know about their motivations?
Well, that's a good, again, a very good question. The Durrani dynasty, which is the major dynasty, well, is the dynasty, in the 18th century. There's been some good work on that. There's been some good work on the so-called Iron Emir of the late 19th century. There's been work on the interwar situation in Afghanistan. And I think you're correct. I mean, I wouldn't call it playing off. I would say they're trying to follow their own policy. And that means they have to navigate through a situation, as any second-rank power is. You know, the British may start to get used to this. You have to navigate in a world in which other people have requirements, demands, opportunities, and you have to decide whether you wish to respond and how far you wish to respond. I mean, on the whole, you know, let's be clear about this. Russian policy is set in St. Petersburg. That is the capital. If you're sitting in St. Petersburg in 1880, your central concerns are, you know, what are the Prussians going to do? Well, the Germans, as we now would they call them, what are the Austrians going to do? You know, do we develop an alliance entente with France, or do we keep in the dry Kaiserbund? If you're looking at Asia, what do we make of these Japanese? You know, Afghanistan is low down the priorities. Mm-hmm. The British have got, you know, they've had the humiliating embarrassment of the first Anglo-Afghan war. But if you look realistically at British foreign policy outside Europe between 1830 and 1900. Yes, there are moments of significance for Afghanistan. The Second Anglo-Afghan War, Maywand, of course, and the Penjdar crisis. But most of the time, it's pretty secondary. You know, you're not having people say in 1862, do we intervene in the American Civil War or do we fight the Afghans? You know, it's do we intervene in the American Civil War? That's the key issue. The concern about Russian expansionism in the late 1870s focuses on Russian expansionism into and in the Balkans. The one in the 1850s had focused on, again, the Balkans. You know, the war is in Crimea, but focuses on in the Balkans. So I think one's got to put the British have other, you know, Second China War in the late 1850s. There are other issues that are more significant. Clearly, for the India Army lobby, I think it's fair to say they would not necessarily have shared that. But one of the great problems in, and Britain is not alone in this, in people who write on defense, is so many of them go native to whichever is the service they're supposedly reporting on. I mean, and they fail to look at a broader strategic sense. And I think, you know, I've written a history of strategy, I've written extensively on the limitations of the question of whether the art of strategy has been lost. Let me make it clear, as you know, we have discussed this, I'm happy to discuss it again. The notion that strategy and politics are somehow separate and can be separated is naive and childish. It is an idea that has been pushed very strongly by some commentators in the last 10 years. I don't wish to name them because it's not fair. They're not here to reply. And obviously, it suits military commentators and the military who like the idea that, you know, they can keep the politicians at bay. It's ridiculous because national interests, national concerns and prioritization, which is the fundamental factor of strategy, is a political construction. Mm-hmm. You can see that at the present moment in the case of the United States. I feel a lot of sympathy for American strategists at the moment. They're having to decide how do they play both concerns about China and concerns about Russia, whilst at the same time as second or third order concerns they have Southwest Asia, including Iran, let alone maybe let's give some thought to Venezuela. But, you know, how on earth you do that? And for somebody to say, oh, it's easy, strategy, it's always clear what's in the national interest. I mean, this is just absurd. I mean, obviously, the choices made feed through into the alliances, the compromises, the weapon systems and procurement, the doctrines you enunciate, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I do think possibly we ought, you know, because we're coming towards a close of our sequences on military history for the moment, possibly we ought to have one in which we do a reprise and discuss this element of strategy, and more particularly, because I think you've raised a very good point, how that relates to where we are at the present day. Because for many people, they look at military history as a kind of escape. Many people, I have to say, I was speaking in London this week, and I was very struck by an observation. I mean, you know, it's not one I disagree with, but in fact, I've made it myself, but you're not used to hearing it repeated. That the face of battle stuff, which so much of the, you know, war literature is about, just tells you what everybody knows, the experience of, you know, conflict. Some people find it exciting, some fearful, unit cohesion, your mates is important. Some people behave well, some people behave badly. Fine, doesn't tell you why one side beats another, doesn't tell you how military systems develop. And one of the problems is, I would say, that a lot of the writing on war lacks sufficient rigor, particularly on the strategic side.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to bring in, you mentioned Iran a moment ago, Persia as it then was. Russian interests in spreading its influence in Persia, how much did that worry the British? To what extent was finding a settlement with the Russians in Persia related to finding a settlement on the Afghan and Indian border? And related to that, the arrival of Germany as a geopolitical player, particularly just before the First World War, with the investment in the Berlin-Baghdad railway, does that also play a part?
Yes. I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. Persia is a concern right through the 19th century. It's a concern of the so-called route to India. One of my PhD students did a PhD on the telegram routes and the routing of the telegrams, both the question as to whether it should be along southern Persia or whether it should be through the Persian Gulf. This was geopolitically of concern at the most specifics of levels. There was anxiety about how Persia would interact with Afghanistan, how Persia might interact with British India. I mean, in a sense, if you think about it, they end up with a common boundary because in Baluchistan, Pakistan has a border with Iran. So you're absolutely right. That was a major concern. And if you want to bring in a broader conception of British policy to include the Navy was much more interested in the Persian Gulf than they ever were interested in what's going on. The modern Navy can fire missiles into Afghanistan or launch helicopters or that direction. Modern, you know, the 19th century Navy couldn't at all. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. As you will know, part of the Anglo-Russian Entente of 1907 includes the drawing of spheres of influence in Persia. And that incidentally looks towards, you know, we're interested in continuity, that looks towards the Anglo-Soviet, I should say, occupation of Iran in World War II, which again sees occupation zones and again is aimed at trying to lessen German influence. They'd been concerned about German influence. And as you may know, British troops, not in great numbers, go not only into what is now Iraq, which was Turkish, part of the Turkish Empire in World War I, but also go into sections of Persia, you know, particularly the southwest. So, yes, there is concern about Germany. Germany's Turkish policy is one that is very interesting because Turkey reconfigures itself after the Young Turks Rebellion. I mean, the origins of this are already there earlier, but it accentuates it after the Young Turks take over, so-called Young Turks, because Turkey becomes more of a Turkish ethnic state, which again is a long-term process. You see it today with Turkish hostility to their Kurdish minorities, and you see it with earlier genocide about towards the Armenians. Does that mean we won't be broadcast in Turkey? Oh dear. You can see that with a kind of more Turkish ethnic state empire, which really, incidentally, hits the Arabs quite hard. And there is this sense that the Turkish Empire prior to World War I is not only falling to pieces in Europe, where it falls to pieces in the First Balkan War, but is also under growing pressure in what you might call Arabistan. Now, whom is going to benefit from that is unclear, but in one respect, the Germans, who, as you know, are the inspiration of the Young Turks, provide them for a lot of their military assistance, in one respect, they're investing in a weak vessel. Now, they're not the first or the last Western or outside power to do that elsewhere in the world. And again, you could argue the same thing can be seen in aspects of power and politics over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Finally, you mentioned the alliance of 1907, which in essence gives Russia a sphere of influence in Persia, on the understanding it ceases to try and influence Tibet and Afghanistan. Is that really the moment, insofar as you can pin it down to one moment, the moment when the great game loses real meaning? Or was it actually the First World War and the Bolshevik Republic and all the eruptions that come from that war that ended the great game?
Well, that's an excellent question. You see, I would argue there was continuity thereafter. I mean, the Soviet Union in the early 1920s is trying to expand its influence, for example, in Iran. What I would say, and you could argue, I'm sure you would have found Russian commentators of the time, Soviet commentators of the time, saying that people who the British support for, including from Mackinder, incidentally, for Armenia, Azerbaijan and Georgia as independent republics, which was during the Russian Civil War, you could say that was, you know, the evil Brits playing a role. So I would say more complex, but I think you get it right absolutely by saying that Anglo-Russian relations improved before the First World War. Now, there have been what some scholars who've argued that the improvement only goes so far. True, but it's a damn sight different to nearly going to war as they've done, you know, as in 1877, 78 and 1885, and actually going to war in 1854, 56. So I would say there is that improvement, that represents a change. Now, you've left it at that point. Can I add, because this is shocking, Graham, you're part of this metropolitan elite, shamefully so, can I add the cultural resonances of the great game? And you are obviously knowing what I'm talking about. What am I talking about? The great cultural resonance of the great game in British popular culture over the last 60 years.
I was going to say Flashman.
Flashman's a good answer, but no, one that was much more pertinent.
Carry on up the Khyber.
Yes, with Kenneth Williams as the Qazi, and you know, Peter Butterworth. You know, and it leads to one of the most memorable lines to me, which shows quite a lot about British humour, of a gentle humour. These days, everybody's supposed to say how shocking it is and all the rest of it, but a gentle humour of a previous generation. Just to remind listeners, the British local governor is Sir Sidney Rough Diamond, played by Sid James. His wife, Lady Rough Diamond, played by Joan Sims, is excited by the Qazi, the name of the local ruler, native ruler, who is played by Kenneth Williams. And she wishes to have a relationship with him. So she goes to see him and she tries to get him interested in her. For the benefit of listeners of a young generation or foreigners who've never seen this, Kenneth Williams, the actor that played these roles, was a homosexual and very clearly acted the role. So he is sort of being very distant as Joan Sims makes her approaches to him. And in the end, she loses her temper and she says, "Why won't you make love to me?" And he says to her, and it's just such a wonderful line, make love, I have people to do that for me." Good evening, Graham.
That's a wonderful note to end on. Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through The Great Game and ending with Karen Up the Khyber, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.